Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC empowers you to experience Jewish paths toward a life of joy, purpose, and meaning through innovative Jewish learning and wellness programs, community building, and initiatives to develop the next generation of Jewish leaders. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 306, Circumcision, Ignorance, and Bris. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rothberg.
And today, this episode is coming out on Christmas Eve, so we want to wish a Merry Christmas to all of our Jewish and non-Jewish listeners who celebrate Christmas. And I especially wanted to note that if you look in your Christmas stocking or under the tree and you don't find any Judaism Unbound merch, you can correct that situation yourself by just going on the Judaism Unbound store and buying some merch for yourself. That's at www.judaismunbound.com/store. And I will tell you that we don't make much money from that merch. It's basically more or less a selling it at cost. So if you really want to help us out and we're getting close to the end of the tax year, you can make a donation to Judaism Unbound. And we really appreciate that. And honestly, we really need it. And so if you go to www.judaismunbound.com/donate, you can make a donation to Judaism Unbound, an end of year donation. We often suggest $1 for every hour you've spent with us over the last year. But you can also support us by a small monthly contribution. $4 or $5 goes a long way. And if you're really looking for end of tax year donations that are significant for you, of course, any gift at any amount is helpful. But if you're in a position to give larger amounts, we really do think that we're doing worthy and important work. And we very much appreciate any larger donations that you're able to send our way. So today is our kind of wrap-up conversation on the set of episodes we've been doing on circumcision. And so, Lex, I have found this series one of the most thought-provoking for me and one of the ones that has pushed me to do my own research almost more than any of the other series that we've done. And also, we've already heard from people who have listened to those episodes, and we're starting to hear stories in a way that we don't often hear so many stories in response to episodes that we do, and are discovering that this really is hitting people very personally, that they have had experiences where they have been essentially pushed away from Jewish organizations because of having made a decision not to circumcise their children. And before we go on, I just want to say about the title for this episode. We thought it was a interesting and provocative title, so we went with it. We're not trying to assert that anyone in particular is being ignorant here. We're not trying to say that you're ignorant if you do circumcision. We're not trying to say you're ignorant if you don't do circumcision. We're trying to say, I think, we're trying to suggest that there is a lot of opinion in both directions about circumcision, and most folks who have opinions haven't actually done a lot of the research, don't really know a ton about the reasons why we do it and the reasons why we might not do it. And so when we talk about ignorance, it may be that the real ignorance that we end up talking about is the ignorance of folks who are excluding people from the Jewish community or making it hard for them to be part of the Jewish community, when that doesn't really need to be that way in terms of what we actually know about what the traditional Jewish law approaches, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's really one of these topics that I'm feeling like, okay, this is a topic that's important in its own right. And it pushes me to want to think about the many other topics that we have talked about and some that we haven't, which might be having similar impacts on people, such as, for example, intermarriage and things like that. So I'm wondering where you're sitting at this stage with that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sitting similarly to you in thinking that this a set of conversations was really, really among the most important we've had on the podcast. And circumcision is absolutely at or near the top of the list of complicated, hard conversations to have in Jewish life. But it actually, I don't know if it's that it's less prominent on that list than things like Israel or intermarriage, or it's equally prominent, but we're more uncomfortable about how it connects to our bodies. It connects to like something, I don't know, primal or ancient, like, but for whatever set of reasons, even we did not really think to make it a subject of our conversations for a really long time. And so we've mentioned that a couple of times, but I really want to acknowledge it and call on other people to just sort of inquire of yourself. Have you spoken about this with friends of yours? That it's not that we all need to be talking about this at, you know, the first word of the Kiddush after services and like dive into circumcision. But I do think it would be a healthier Jewish world if we were with people we trust and with people we can have deep conversations with, actually talking about circumcision. I do understand why for certain folks at certain life stages, which by the way is not only becoming a parent, but also maybe becoming a grandparent, there are moments where it makes sense that on a personal level, one would start to think about this. But I actually think one of the problems we have in Jewish life is that we only sort of think about whatever thing is facing us directly, and we're not zooming out and thinking about the grand picture. And so I hope those of us like me who don't have any kids, although maybe at some point that will change, I really do believe in the Jewish collective, right? And that means that things that don't affect us as individuals, we should be trying to think about deeply. So in terms of what I've been thinking about deeply in particular with these last few conversations, it's actually not, is circumcision good or bad? If I do have an assigned male at birth child, what would I do? I mean, I'm thinking about those a little bit, I'm not going to lie. Like, but I am more thinking about sort of what we've been saying with, say, intermarriage or Israel. Like, the question isn't, should one intermarry or not intermarry? The question is, given that lots of people exist who have intermarried and they have families and they are participating in Jewish life, how do we relate to those families? I would say the same thing. And by the way, Israel, like the issue is not what should people think about Israel. I mean, that is an issue. But like another issue is, given that people are anti-Zionist and knocking on the doors of Jewish buildings and wanting to participate, how might one relate to them? Like, depending on who you are and what you think.
Right.
With this, given that people are making the decision not to circumcise their assigned male at birth children, what would Jewish organizations do with respect to those people? Would they stigmatize those people? Would they discourage that choice? Would they try to push them at a later stage in life to do a circumcision? Or would they actually say, that's cool, that's fine, we're a space that will welcome you alongside others who have made different decisions? And I'd kind of like to dwell in that set of conversations a great deal, because I think even for people who actually would defend circumcision as a practice, there are some indefensible things happening towards families that have made a different decision.
So I agree. I am also thinking about the question of circumcision itself, not so much is it right or wrong, just more like that question of like, what would I do if I were in this position again? I that is a live question for me that might be of interest to discuss. But let's assume that we're talking about what you're saying, that there are people in the Jewish community who are circumcising their children, and that's one valid choice. And there's people in the Jewish community that are not circumcising their children. What should Jewish institutions do about that? Or what should new Jewish projects do about that? You know, how should people look at that? And I guess I'm thinking about this on a few levels. One is that, what is the Jewish sort of official, and I put that in quotations, you know, but what is like the official Jewish position on circumcision that we've like inherited, right? And it's pretty clear, I think, that the official position is A, you should do it, but B, if you don't do it, you're still a Jew. You're not actually not allowed to do anything other than eat the Passover sacrifice. And I was very interested in that on two levels. One was that, like, okay, so we have in the legal literature one thing that you're not allowed to do if you are uncircumcised. And also what Shia Cohen brought out about that idea that it's not a precedent. It's not necessarily a precedent. Like, just because an uncircumcised Jew is not allowed to eat the Passover sacrifice, which, by the way, we haven't been doing for 2,000 years. So just to be clear for people that are not tracking Passover rituals, what we do for Passover today, have a Seder and all that, none of that is the Passover sacrifice. The Passover sacrifice was a very particular thing that you did in the temple in Jerusalem, et cetera, et cetera. So there was like one thing that uncircumcised people couldn't do, but that has never been used, shouldn't say never, but that is not generally used in the law as a precedent for other things that people can't do. Interesting thing number two is like Shia Cohen's hypothesizing that it's really much more a kind of mystical idea that circumcision was a way to ward off, you know, the angel of death, the destroyer. So, okay, like, I guess I would say to people, if you have serious concerns about the angel of death coming around, then you can think about it in those terms. You know, and again, we've talked about this, and we talked about this a few episodes. You know, people often say, I'm not bar mitzvahed, so therefore I'm not fully Jewish. And that is completely wrong from a Jewish law standpoint. You know, we could talk about folk Judaism, and we will. But from a, like, again, official line situation, it's not true that if you didn't have a bar mitzvah or a bat mitzvah or a bat mitzvah or anything, it's not true that there's anything that happens to you. Nothing, zero. So this idea that has come into the folk notion that somehow having a bar mitzvah matters to whether you're like officially Jewish, similar with circumcision. So many people have this notion that somehow I am not really fully Jewish if I'm not circumcised, and that just doesn't seem to have any bearing in the law. Now, the question then comes in, what about the folk beliefs? And that was the other thing that for me was really eye-opening from our conversation with Shia Cohen, that it seems like this idea that your Judaism is somehow in question if you're not circumcised comes from the Zohar, the mystical tradition. And that was, when it was written, a minority, a very small minority piece of work. It has over time become more accepted by various streams of Judaism, like Hasidism, etc. But it still doesn't represent like the sort of most down the middle authoritative Jewish tradition. But what really seems to be is that it kind of represents that over time, Jews started to give more and more significance to this practice. And I don't actually discount that, right? Because we've lauded many folk traditions on this podcast, like Tashlich and Kol Nidre and various things that the folk have wanted to do that maybe the rabbis didn't want. But there can also be things that the folk wanted to do, like bar mitzvahs or circumcisions, or not wanted to do, but wanted to give it elevated significance, that we can look at and say, yeah, so that's okay. I mean, we could say that was okay for the time when that was happening, but that doesn't mean that it has to still be okay moving forward. And there are some people, and I think I would be one of them, that would say, if it doesn't have a strong basis in the legal tradition or a strong basis in the textual tradition, then I'm more open. I'm open to changing things that are in the legal and textual tradition, but I'm a little more open to changing it if it's just a folk tradition, right? And other people might see it completely the opposite. No, I mean, like, other people might see it completely the opposite, but I'm just saying that, like, you and I have had like questions about like why I'm always so interested in the Torah and whatnot. It is because I think there is a little more gravitas to older things. That does not in any way mean that I don't think we can overturn them. I think we can, but I think it might require a little more heavy lifting. So that's kind of one thing that I just want to kind of get out there.
Yeah. So I'm really interested to hear you say that. I don't know if I agree that for me, the lack of a strong legal tradition saying circumcision makes you a Jew, say, like, I don't know that I would say what you just said around, like, that sort of makes me even a little more willing to question it. For me, I think I do see, and this gets to my whole framework of like, oh, I think pop culture is Torah. I think books that didn't make the Bible are Torah. I think, like, I equalize sources that are sort of official in quotes and sources that are not official, which is to say folk stuff. And so I think I actually wouldn't say what you just said, but I agree or co-sign. It's like I'm a concurring Supreme Court justice in one of the opinions where I don't quite want to use the same exact argument, but I agree roughly with where you concluded there. The folk piece is really important. And I share what you said about how, like, we can't ignore that, like, on this show, we've actually called out many times saying, you know, listen to what sort of the people want and not just what rabbis are deciding and writing and stuff. Like, and by the way, I'm not as big a Kol Nidre defender, but like that is an example of like a melody or a prayer that like has been retained in many circles because people seem to connect to it, not because rabbis do. Rabbis have actually criticized it over and over and over again. But the folk can change. Folks change. People change. And where I would really question Shia Cohen is the present tense. And by the way, I think Shia Cohen in terms of historical context, in terms of giving us like the contours of how circumcision has evolved and shifted in Jewish life, was so valuable. And he, what he largely points out is that like what circumcision was initially was sort of a much more moderated version, the surgical procedure, like a much more moderated version than what it would become. And I think that matters in terms of how we talk about, oh, this has been around for millennia. Like, where I challenge him is, like, I believe that the folk today are not where they were even a couple decades ago. And I can't prove that. I haven't done any sociological studies. I don't know. I'd actually love for there to be questions in surveys about circumcision and how Jews approach it today. But I think that how your typical American person, I am speaking mostly about an American context. I don't really know globally, but my sense, and Rebecca and Eliyahu and Lisa seem to agree with this, is that the idea that circumcision is just sort of what most assigned male children, like a procedure that most of them do, that was the case for the latter half of the 20th century. And I think it's still largely the case, but I'm not sure that it's quite as enshrined as it once was. And I think that as that shifts generally beyond just Jews, it will have a huge impact on what Jews believe or do with respect to this issue. So like, I believe we should really be watching that closely, but I also don't think that that should be driving things. I really appreciated the part of Rebecca said, like, folks who aren't Jewish do kind of look to Jews to lead on this issue, which is a nice thing, right? Like there's a recognition that Jews have a relationship to circumcision historically. And so us really stepping back and having a bias-free conversation about like how do we think, or as bias-free as we can, conversation about it, like what do we think about this? That would be really useful. And I think that we're not quite doing it because we're allowing ourselves to be pulled by all of our social connections, the patchwork that Max described, of people, including ourselves, who have either had this ritual done to them or chosen to do it to their children. And that's not, that being the primary thing that keeps a traditional thing happening is not something I'm comfortable with. If there's other arguments, great.
What I'm focusing on is the question of like, why should we do this? And we talked about, you know, that why should we? Like, let's make an argument, something that is kind of a form of surgery. Like, we don't have surgery lightly, most of us. And so a form of surgery that is just kind of a serious procedure, it feels to me like you should really make a strong argument for it, as opposed to the strong argument having to be that we stop doing it. That's kind of where I'm sitting with it. And that's where I want to kind of frame that side of it. Like, what's the argument for it? And that's why I'm so interested in the information that suggests that circumcision is not as central to Judaism as we may be taught or we might have thought. And to the extent that it is kind of central, and I'm not denying that it's important, that it's been seen as important, that for many thousands of years, we have had a story of Abraham being circumcised as a sign of the covenant with God, and that we have built Judaism, at least in part, many of us, on that idea of that covenant. So I'm not suggesting that it's not kind of centrally located within Judaism. But what I am saying is that the more that I have a sense that it might have been something that Jews took seriously and did, but there are other things that Jews took seriously and did that we no longer do, like bringing sacrifices at the temple. You could say we couldn't bring sacrifices at the temple anymore because the temple was burned down, but it could have easily been that the Jews would have said, yeah, but we can't give up the sacrifices. That's the central thing in Judaism. So we can't do it at the temple anymore, but now we can bring sacrifices elsewhere. But they didn't make that decision. When circumstances changed, they said, this thing that was central doesn't have to be something that we continue to do because something changed that makes us question that. So my submission here is that something may have changed or may change in the future that says, you know what, we don't feel great about this circumcision anymore. And by the way, that something might be actually something that we didn't really discuss in great depth in this series, but I would really like to think about this in relation to the changes that we are thinking about in terms of gender in our society today, because that is at a relatively early point, and my sense is it's going to change everything. My sense is in 50 years from now, we're going to think of gender in profoundly different ways than most of us are thinking about it today. And what we're seeing right now is just the leading edge of that. And in that world, you know, what sense does it make to continue to do a tradition that is based on gender from the way they saw it 2,000, 3,000 years ago? So I think so much is going to change that maybe for those who are saying, hey, it hasn't changed yet in that way, first of all, I'd say it has, but for those who are out there saying, like, for me, it hasn't changed yet, I might say, okay, but like, let's at least have this interesting thought experiment for something that's likely to change a lot within our lifetime or soon thereafter, and frame that. So the last thing that I kind of just want to note is just this idea that to the extent that you think that circumcision is something very central to Judaism, a lot of people will peg that to the Abraham story and the covenant with God. And right now, I'm talking to the people who are our listeners who don't really believe that that actually happened. Some of our listeners do believe that that actually happened, and I respect them very much. But to the extent that many of us who are listening to this podcast, and in my case, at least talking in this podcast, don't actually believe that a personal God and a guy named Abraham had a conversation and made a deal, and Abraham undertook on behalf of everybody in perpetuity that we would circumcise ourselves in order to be a sign of that deal, that I don't actually believe that that happened in real life. That's a story, that's a myth, that's a metaphor that we use. And I love talking with Shia Cohen about the idea of the metaphor of the circumcising your heart. You know, that there's an idea that even in the Bible itself, even in the Torah itself, circumcision is seen as both a practical thing to do and a metaphor. So I don't actually think it's such a big jump to say that we can look at that story and see that as symbolic, as metaphorical, as significant, but not necessarily having to mean that we should actually undergo the surgical procedure. Certainly not the extreme extra way that the Maccabees or the, you know, whoever was around then and then the rabbis made it, which was not the circumcision of Abraham practically. You know, it just seems like it's much more open than that is all I'm saying. And once it's more open than that, then I feel like we should be allowed to think about it, talk about it, and come to different decisions without being penalized by the institutions of an infrastructure of Judaism that actually is not thinking about it that deeply.
I have one quick thought that isn't fully formed yet, but I'm just going to like put it out there for others to maybe think about. I'm realizing like there is actually a Jewish ritual that involves cutting that is not a surgical procedure that many, although not as many as circumcision, like that many families and people do, which is in more traditionalist homes, the first haircut is a big deal. And I'm realizing like all of the issues with like the surgical procedure, or not all, I guess, but most of the issues of a surgical procedure, maybe all, go away when it's not a permanent procedure. Maybe that takes away the power of that ritual. But I'm asking without an answer yet, like, what if that ritual actually became a more central thing and the cutting that is involved with cutting hair were actually treated as a kind of circumcision of the hair, like there's already circumcision of the heart, circumcision of the penis. Like, is there something there where we could build meaning in that sense, which is still like it's the first haircut, it's still a young child, but it would be different. Anyway, that's a quick thought. The other thing I wanted to build on, respond to, is what you said about like some people actually believe Abraham and God came to this deal and other people don't think that happened. And I really think there's something important to say there, which is for so many of us that don't believe that happened, I think we believe or we are made to feel that in Jewish spaces, we sort of should play a game of make-believe that we do think they happened in order to come to certain kinds of meaning making. I fully disagree with that. there are moments where I would contradict myself, by the way. Like, I do think there is value in the Passover Seder, where we do kind of play a game of make-believe, in my view, where we say we were slaves in Egypt. I actually don't think that my ancestors were slaves in Egypt, and I don't think that story happened in the way it is described. But I do think there is value in doing that reenactment. This one, I'm less sure about. And what I would really bring up more broadly is, are we, who don't think that the Bible is necessarily a historical account, are we going to continue to see ourselves as like guests on the turf of Judaism that does think those things happened? And sure, lots of Jews happen to not think they happened, but like when they're in a synagogue or a Sunday school or a JCC, or maybe not a JCC, but like other kinds of bodies that are Jewish representers in some way or another, like we're sort of going to enter onto their terms. Or are we going to say, huh, if enough Jews think a thing and are feeling a strong connection to Judaism, that becomes a true authentic Jewish thing. So there is actually authenticity and meaning and community and etc. to create out of those who relate to that Abraham story in a deep way. I do actually hold that story and all of the Torah, even the parts I think are really bad, I do hold it as my story. I do relate to it in a way that I don't relate to many other kinds of stories. And I reflect on it, you know, on a yearly calendar every year. Can we actually say, oh, we now have the legs to stand on where we can craft meaning from the standpoint of Judaisms that believe roughly in biblical criticism, that those are actually Judaisms. They're not a set of people who have rejected Judaism. And I would basically call on us not to play that game of make-believe. And with respect to this ritual, what that means is not that we automatically jump and say, oh, there's no longer any rationale for circumcision because the only rationale is that Abraham did it and I don't think that story happened. Like that would be way oversimplified.
Right.
But at the very least, we enter into that conversation from a place of, oh, given my terms, given our terms, that the Bible is not a historical account and that we wouldn't do anything based on the fact that the Bible says it happened because we don't necessarily believe it's a historical account, what are the arguments where we would still do it? I struggle to come up with arguments in the positive for why we would do this particular surgical procedure on 8-day-old children. I say struggle. I don't say that I am entirely convinced there are none. And that points to me to a real need to actually enter into this conversation and to do so with the confidence that we don't have to use the terms that other people have, which is to say that Genesis is either historical or if it's not historical, like we have to sort of treat it as if it were historical in order to be part of this Jewish context. Like, I don't accept that. And I think that those of us who are, you know, unbound Jews, we have to, some of this is on us. Like, we actually have to step up and say, we're actually in this conversation. It's not just that we sort of observe as Jews who do think Abraham and God came to an agreement, make decisions, and we either follow those decisions or not. We are in the game. I keep using that term. I don't have a better one to use. We are players, to use B'nai Lapi's language. And that means there's a responsibility on us to operate by our rules, not by other people's.
So you mentioned B'nai Lapi. I was thinking as you were talking about B'nai's story of being in the closet so that she could go to rabbinical school at the Jewish Theological Seminary at a time when they didn't accept LGBTQ rabbinical students. And she talks about it in a way that I find very, very moving. Other people might find it transgressive, and maybe both. But like, I find it very moving that she says, I had to do that in order to get the Torah, because she hadn't been given the Torah. She hadn't been given education in Talmud, and there was nowhere else to get it. She said, I had to do that. I had to go into the closet to bring the Torah to my people, who, what she means is the LGBTQ community. And I think of that story, first of all, I find it just incredibly moving. I find it incredibly tragic. But when I hear that story from B'nai, I often think of the story in Greek literature of Prometheus stealing fire from the gods. And that's a story that I don't believe that there was actually a guy named Prometheus. I don't believe that the gods exist. I don't believe that they had fire and were withholding it for humans. I don't believe that any of that literally happened. And at the same time, when I hear Binet tell that story, I often immediately think of Prometheus, and it makes it more powerful for me because I have this myth that means a lot to me as a story, as something that talks about how, you know, those in charge can withhold from people what they need, and it's and that people have the right to go in and take that if that's the only way, right, et cetera, et cetera. People can make other meanings on that story or on the Abraham story, but my point is just saying, just because I don't believe that that story is literally true doesn't mean I don't believe it's enormously significant, and doesn't mean that even the thing that I'm questioning here, circumcision, is something that I can't find a new way to make meaning out of, and we're invited to do all of those things. I do want to say one thing to our listeners that comes out of what you were saying. Many of the rabbis of these synagogues don't believe that the actual covenant literally happened either, mm-hmm. that a guy named mm-hmm. Abraham talked to a personal God. They don't believe that. And so some of them really do. And again, I respect them. But I think it's important, like, what if it turns out that the vast majority of congregants who think about it one way or the other don't think that? Then we're all playing this game of make-believe, and it's hurting people. And that's where I want to kind of shift the conversation at this stage to what Bruchim is really all about. And to say, you know, sometimes things happen in the world and there's collateral damage. And you say, well, look, the thing that we're trying to do is important enough that I should acknowledge that it's hurting people and I should feel really bad about that. But it's still the right thing to do because, you know, for some reason, it's the right thing to do. And here, I'm not talking about circumcision itself. Now, what I'm talking about is the making people who don't circumcise feel bad or feel not part of the community. Let's say for the rest of this part of the conversation that we take as a given that circumcision is okay to do, that you can make good arguments for it, et cetera, et cetera. But you can also make good arguments not to do it. If we then have a world in which most of the rabbis and most of the congregants don't really believe the sort of claims of Jewish literature as to why we do this, but they might have other reasons for thinking it's good. You know, it's good to carry on a tradition for thousands of years. It's good to, you know, have this reminder in our body. There could be all kinds of arguments that you can make that it's good. Fine. But that's saying it's good is different from saying that the other is bad. And once we're in that situation, then to say to someone, I am going to make the personal decision because it's not supported by Jewish law. It's only supported by a certain perspective on Jewish folk behavior. And I am going to use that to hurt people and to drive people away from Jewish involvement. I'm going to say to people, and we're hearing these stories from the last few episodes, that there are rabbis who have said to kids, you know, have said to parents, your kid cannot enroll in the Hebrew school in my synagogue. Your kid is not eligible to have, to have the privilege of a bar mitzvah because they are uncircumcised.
And sometimes they're siblings too, like siblings who aren't even assigned male. Like, that's what I'm getting at.
Yeah, and I want to say, like, that should be understood to be a personal decision that these rabbis or these institutions are making. And they should take responsibility for making that decision, number one. And the question is, like, do you want to take responsibility for making that decision once you acknowledge that there's actually no support for doing that decision? In other words, what I'm saying, driving people away. Number two, do the members of that institution want to continue to be part of and to affirm these policies by the institution once they realize that it's only a personal decision being made by the leadership of those institutions that is not demanded by Jewish law or history? And do they want to be part of that? Or should members of institutions all be asking their leadership, what is our policy here, whether it applies to them directly or not? But if they hear that our policy is not to allow people who are uncircumcised to have these, to be part of our community, to go to Hebrew school, to have bar mitzvahs, if they hear that from their institution, whether it affects them personally or not, I would call on them to stand up and say, we need to change our policy. This is not right. And the third thing is, and this is, I think, a lot harder, is assuming that our institution actually is open to people that are not circumcised. Do we want to demand that all of those institutions make that absolutely public And I certainly would say yes, but I think that that's a major question. And that's going to be hard for example, I want to tell you, that's going to be hard for example, conservative rabbis who may have all kinds of things going on in there that are maybe not laws per se, but that are like norms in their institutions where they would get in trouble or they would get kind of called on the carpet if they were to put on their website that they welcome uncircumcised people. But nevertheless, it's not actually supported by Jewish law.
Yeah. So I want to really carry that forward. And first off, I think there's people who make decisions about circumcision, which is pretty much exclusively adults. And then there's people who are the subjects of those decisions. And I want to say this really clearly. No child should be subject to any rules or any exclusions at all because of what their parents decided to do or not do to them. It is absolutely, I'm saying this as like clearly and with as few caveats as I can. I want to be like really, really direct. A child who did not make a choice whatsoever about their body, who is 3 years old or 6 years old or 13 years old, and either they want to be a part of Jewish life or their family would like them to be a part of Jewish life. The idea that they would be penalized, that they would be treated differently because of something they didn't control whatsoever, and that a kind of temporary or permanent stigma would be on them because of something entirely independent of their own choices is repulsive to me. And the idea that we wouldn't shout to the rooftops, children who are 5 years old will not be barred from our school based on any decisions that their family made, is terrible. If you want to say our organization is going to relate to people who have chosen, to the parents or to others who have chosen not to circumcise in a certain set of ways because we're an organization that stands for circumcision, like, that's one thing. I don't like that either, but like that is not something I would go on this kind of caveat-free rant about. Mm-hmm. Like that is complicated. And I do think that as much as I'm not somebody who would do that, an organization saying, if you decide not to circumcise, there's a set of things that you're not going to be permitted to do in our space. Like I could see that happening. But I'm like, I can't watch and see these stories about how a five-year-old isn't allowed to enroll in a Sunday school and their sibling who's two, I'm making up, this isn't anybody's specific story, but it's a sort of taken from a few stories and that are real. And their sibling, as a penalty to the family for making this decision, will also not be allowed to enroll, independent of the fact that that sibling doesn't have a penis and the circumcision issue wasn't even an issue at all. There's not enough words in me to say how upset that makes me. And so, by the way, you could throw camps into this, throw every organization that serves young children. I would really like our listeners who are adjacent to or members of organizations that serve young children to go and ask what the policies are, whether they're written policies or, as is maybe just as often, not written, but sort of implied, where there's nothing on the books, but when a student wants to enroll, the rabbi says they can't. Look, do I think that it's the predominant majority that are turning away young children? No, I don't think that. But I think it's common enough, and people are sort of sliding by and doing this, and also pretending it's got precedent in Jewish law, which, like Shia Cohen said, it doesn't. Sure, Jewish law likes circumcision and wants and thinks it's really great, but it doesn't say if you don't have it, you can't be part of a Jewish community. Like, young children are being turned away from Jewish life, and the reason for it is something that was entirely out of their control.
I mean, 100% endorse what you said. I think there are two questions that folks should be asking their institutional leaders. Number one, what is the policy of this institution? And like you said, I think often you'll probably hear, we actually don't ask, or we would be fine with it, or it's really not an issue. But some of the times you're going to hear things that say, no, we wouldn't accept them. So that's a good question to ask. And the second question, on the assumption that our policy is that we would accept such folks, that are we saying that publicly? Because the issue is that a lot of people, and I know this from personal experience of folks that I know, that people out there believe very strongly that Jewish institutions don't accept people who are uncircumcised. And so they assume that if your institution doesn't say that we do accept such folks, they assume that you don't. And so it's not so simple as, like, you know, don't ask, don't tell, or that we just don't put the information out there and we'll deal with people that come forward. Most people assume that your policy is that you don't accept people that are uncircumcised. So those simple inquiries and suggestions that you should, you know, suggest to people that you should put it on the website or whatever, those are pretty simple and I think would make a huge difference in the world. I mean, they would actually help people that are being hurt by the Jewish community. I mean, that's the core piece, like, ethically, that I want to say. Like, if the Jewish community is hurting people, then we're all complicit in that unless we act affirmatively to stop that hurt from happening. So I take this very seriously. I also want to note that a lot of times on this show, we're often saying, like, this show isn't really so much about the existing infrastructure of Jewish institutions. Like, mm-hmm. it's just not really our core interest. We're always really interested in the more marginal, out of the, you know, out of the mainstream kind of institutions and startups. I think these are good questions to ask of all startups, of all new organizations. And I also think that, you know, it may be, like, it'll be an interesting experiment to see what happens over the next few months if you know, our listeners really act. You know, if it turns out that there's too much resistance in the Jewish institutions to really being open about this for whatever set of reasons, maybe that itself becomes an additional reason why it's so important to cultivate this new landscape of new Jewish organizations, you know, most of which I think don't really care about that.
I wanted to get at two little things that came up quickly in some of our past episodes. One of them is the idea, both from history with Shaya Cohen and today with Max and Charlene and even with Lisa Eliyahu and Rebecca, about sacrifice. And we've used that word today. Like, circumcision, I mean, we don't think of it as a sacrifice, like, in quotes, in the term of art sense, that, like, there's the Hebrew word korban, and there's the different sacrifices at the temple. Like, it's never been one of those, but it is a kind of sacrifice. And today there's this sense that, like, you're giving up something of yourself for the sake of either the Jewish collective or God. It might depend a little on which kind of Jewish orientation you're inhabiting. I'm not here to say anything being a quote-unquote sacrifice is bad. That's actually not what I think. I think there are many kind. We had Ruby Namdar on the show, and he gave beautiful wisdom. I would even call it Torah, about how there's lots to learn from what was happening with the ancient sacrifices. And there's actually something we lack as Jews because we don't have this sensory, big, large gathering, you know, kind of culture that was associated with the sacrifices. Now, that's not what a circumcision, that's not the kind of sacrifice that a circumcision has been. But I do think there's a reason why different kinds of religious groups have the general idea that you give up something of yourself to grow, whether it's closer to God or to grow closer to your community. That's not inherently a terrible idea. I do think that how we go about those sacrifices is important. Killing animals for the sake of growing closer to God is not something I love or like. Giving a grain offering, which was also done in the ancient sacrifices, I have a lot less of a problem with. You're not ending the life of any living creature in order to do that. You are giving up something of yourself. Cool. There's even some sacrifices that are kind of monetary in ancient texts and today. Like, there's, you know, paying your dues in the literal sense, paying dues. That is a certain kind of sacrifice. That's number one. I just wanted to say, like, I don't think calling circumcision a sacrifice is the same thing as calling it bad. I do think when something is a sacrifice and when it's serving that purpose, we need to be mindful of how we're going about it. Because, by the way, they brought up hazing, right? Like, hazing rituals can be sacrifices too. You know, there can be, like, blood rituals, or there can be something where you give up of yourself in a serious way. And there's many problems with that, especially if it's not consensual. The other little thing that Charlene said in her episode with us is she brought up how for her and for Max, they both have two Jewish parents. They are in a Jewish-Jewish relationship. And so their child, even if they have a child who's assigned male and who is not circumcised, will have many fewer questions around, like, are they really Jewish or not? And I think that's actually a really important thing to name, because part of what circumcision is doing for people who are marginalized in other ways, whose Jewishness is questioned, is they can say, well, look, I had a Brit Milah. Like, I was circumcised. Because there still is this conception out there, even though it's wrong, that circumcision, like, makes you a Jew. If you have a Jewish father but not a Jewish mother, and you had a Brit Milah, all of a sudden, that's like a card in your hand that you can play when people question your Jewish identity. And that I don't want to dismiss. Like, I recognize that there are terrible ways that people are marginalized. And so this is a way that people can bring up the fact that, no, I really am Jewish. And by the way, I think about this, about my own potential children. Like, they will have a Jewish father and not a Jewish mother. And I am aware every day that should they exist one day, they will run into people that tell them they're not Jewish. And if they could say, like, I was circumcised, that would serve them, right? That's not dictating, at least I hope, that's not dictating my decision-making process that I would make about those people. Because I don't think that's how we should be making those decisions. I think we should really be trying to act defensively as little as possible. Oh, other people will think X, Y, or Z. But I want to recognize that that's coming from a place of my own privilege as somebody who hasn't had my Jewishness questioned. I'm Ashkenazi, I'm white, I have two Jewish parents. Like, pretty much every box, I am in the privileged side of the equation within Jewish life. And so I want to say to people who are listening who are like, well, come on, guys. I've had to deal with all this crap, and you're saying that we should take out that this one ritual that allows me to sort of prove myself to people is gone. I want to recognize that that's a layered and really challenging thing to say. So I just wanted to bring up that sacrifice piece and this other one about, like, identity and proving oneself.
And I would just, like, wanted to note as a, you know, sort of a thing to think about in this episode for me is just, like, this question of paternalism. And I see it happening in two ways. One is, look, first of all, you know, anything you do as a parent, first of all, it's inevitably paternalistic by definition, right? Like, or maternalistic, of course, or other istics. Yeah, I don't know.
Non-binary, eternalistic.
Right. And I think about that a lot as a parent. You know, I've thought about that a lot as a parent. It's like, I just think about how, you know, I just remember the moment when my first child was very young and had, like, copied something that I did. And I was like, oh my God, he's watching me all the time. And I'm responsible. And everything that I do is affecting this person in a way that in certain ways probably can't be undone. And in other ways would require, you know, a lot of therapy and whatever. But nevertheless, I do feel like there's something to be said about, to the extent that there are things that you can not do upon your children that are permanent, I kind of feel like you should err on the side of, you know, not being, quote, paternalistic when you can avoid that. And the other paternalism that I think is really a problem, I mean, really, really, I mean, I guess they're both a problem, but is the paternalism of Jewish institutional leadership. And here, I mean, mostly rabbis, but it's not only rabbis necessarily. But this idea that I am going to deny a child a Hebrew school education or a bi mitzvah, basically as a way to deter parents from making that decision that I disagree with, right? Because of course you're not doing anything other than damage to the child. The child doesn't know, didn't make the choice, didn't do anything. Why should the child suffer? I mean, 100% I agree with you. Of course that should never be done. And it's just mind-boggling to me that people have made that decision over the years and continue to. But I can imagine that somebody says, I'm doing this having nothing to do with the child. I'm doing this to disincentivize the family, or I'm doing this to incentivize the family for circumcising their other children because this is so important, or I want this to be an example for other families so that people don't think you can just stop circumcising. And, you know, in the way that you said in, like, these no uncertain terms, you should never do. I'm like, stop having these attempts to force people into a decision. I mean, I have two objections. Number one, people should not be forced or pressured into making Jewish life decisions. people should make Jewish decisions because it calls to them, because it has a gravitational attraction. So if you have members in your community that are not making decisions that you think as a Jewish communal leader or thinker or professional or whatever you think they should be making, your job is to make it compelling in an attractive way for them to make that decision, not to put obstacles in the way that force them to make that decision. Because what kind of Judaism is that? That is a Judaism that I am so uninterested in. And if we can start to see it and frame things in those terms and to say, this isn't like a difference of opinion. This isn't like a interesting political dynamic. This is a situation where somehow we have gotten into a mindset that is okay to harm children.
Producer's note, harm children, not in the sense of the circumcision itself here. We're talking still about harming them through depriving them the ability to have a place in Sunday school or at summer camp or to have various kinds of ritual participation opportunities.
In order to accomplish an end beyond the child is disgraceful. And I don't blame people that are doing it today out of ignorance, right? The ignorance is on the people who are running Jewish organizations that haven't thought about this. I don't blame them because they haven't been invited to think about it. But I think we are inviting them now. And I want to put it in those terms because I think that the ignorance, which is often attributed to the members of Jewish communities, is actually often more held by and more significantly held by those who purport to be leading them.
What I wanted to close out with is sort of the opt-in, opt-out distinction that we spoke about with Max and Charlene. I have a theory about how we approach Jewish rituals, and I haven't totally fleshed it out yet. And Dan, you're a law professor formerly, so you'll be able to help me if I'm totally off base. I believe that we relate to rituals that have disappeared from Judaism in a certain set of ways, and we relate to rituals that are still around that we see as like an unbroken chain in another set of ways. And the analogy I would bring is the Supreme Court or the justice distinction between strict scrutiny and rational basis. With certain laws that are passed, it's incumbent on the government to prove a set of things, this is strict scrutiny. So it's incumbent upon the government to prove that a particular law is basically the only way to get at a specific end goal and that it's narrowly tailored to that end goal.
Yeah, and that end goal is so important that it must be achieved.
Right. And I believe we relate to Jewish rituals that either don't exist yet or have disappeared in the past through strict scrutiny. We say you can only make a new ritual up, you can only create something new, or you can only revive something from the past, like animal sacrifice or some other kind of sacrifice, if it's like the only way that you can achieve a specific goal and that it really does achieve that certain goal. But then we relate to Jewish rituals that have existed for a long time, like circumcision, through the vantage point of rational basis. It's actually not incumbent. So rational basis, it's not incumbent on the government to prove anything. It's incumbent on the person challenging a law to prove that there is like no reason at all that this law should exist. Like the government only has to have a rational basis, which is not to say it's the only form of achieving a certain goal. But then like people outside of the government have to show that it's really not permissible in any respect. That's sort of how I think Max was relating to circumcision. He was saying, like, we should, with Jewish ritual, if we inherit it, we need to find a set of reasons that it's really not morally permissible. And I would push us on both sides of that equation. I would say, what if we actually equalized this and said, stuff that's disappeared from Jewish life? I was just reading an article about Yom Nicanor, a holiday that disappeared. I think if somebody were to argue tomorrow, we should have this holiday, Yom Nicanor, I think they'd have to prove all sorts of things to get a synagogue to actually do that. They'd have to prove that it has its special, unique purpose and that it's really important. And then maybe they'd do it. What if we said, oh, we're actually going to lighten the load for proving that disappeared rituals actually have a purpose or that new rituals have a purpose? And at the same time, we would say, things like circumcision or rituals that we've inherited for a long time, we're actually not just going to assume that they are the best way to get at a particular end goal. We're going to say, let's back out and actually ask a little more challenging set of questions about, is this the way we want to achieve a specific end goal? Circumcision, by the way, like, I think the end goal of creating rituals that like mark entry into the world and mark entry into the Jewish community, even at 8 days old or at super young, like, I like that idea. Would I say that this is the best or the only way to do that? No, I wouldn't. And I don't think most people would, even people who defend circumcision. I think they're not defending based on the terms of strict scrutiny. They're just looking for sort of a rational basis. So I wanted to close with that as a broadening kind of question that we could all sit with. And I apologize that I took a while to get there, but I really appreciate those of you who listened to these set of episodes and challenged yourselves, and especially those of you who are going to challenge your institutions and ask those questions that we encouraged you to earlier. If you have any questions for us, please, please be in touch. You can hit us up via Facebook or Instagram or Twitter. All of those handles are at Judaism Unbound. You can head to our website, judaismunbound.com, or you can email us at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. One last mention that if you are looking with your family to sort of confront any challenging issues related to circumcision or your family's choice not to circumcise, you can head to Bruchim, Bruchim.online, and they have a concierge service that can help you. But thank you so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound. 275 more days of Shemitah.